Without further ado, I want everyone to give these guys your best LA welcome. Science Mike and Michael Gunger.
Off, on, up, down, left, right, north, south, light, dark, matter, space, gay, straight, male, female, Christian, secular, self, not self. Our world is made of opposites. Everything you've ever seen on a computer comes from ones and zeros. Music is sound waves made of beats, a vibration between on and off. The faster that the on-off happens, the higher the pitch. There is no me without a you, and there is no us without a not us. There is no conception of good without also necessitating a concept of evil. So why does this binary way of experiencing reality exist, and how does it influence our experience of our world together? How does it influence our ideas of coming together like this? Who are we? To answer that, we also have to ask, who are we not?
Every good story starts with a hero, right? Well, maybe not. It seems like most of the time we talk about the villain. I mean, who is Luke Skywalker without Darth Vader? Who is Frodo without that burning red eye, right? So in the very nature of story, there is no protagonist without antagonist. There is no hero without an enemy. And the way that our consciousness is structured, the very nature of Homo sapiens using language, sets our life experiences up as a story that makes us the hero and anyone who opposes us the enemy.
How should we think about the enemy, though? So much of human history is playing out this very question. Most of the time, we demonize, we dehumanize, and it seems to always culminate in bloodshed. And that just seems to be who we are. So, how do we deal with this violence, this way that human beings seem to deal with the idea of enemy? There have been philosophical and religious voices through the centuries who have argued against the more mainstream thing, which is violence. But people from all different major religions who have produced individuals and groups who are advocates of pacifism or nonviolence. But as we've talked about on the podcast before, is complete nonviolence even a realistic idea? Is it a tenable position in a world where every living thing needs to eat and every meal kills something? Most of us, we live in this tenuous position of how to relate to the enemy, and how do we love the enemy? Like Jesus said, you know, most of us have probably leanings that way. We heard Jesus say things like, love your enemy, and it sounds really beautiful to our ears. But what does it mean exactly? In some ways, it seems simple. In other ways, it's not. A person sexually assaulting you, for instance, What does that look like to love them? What does it look like for somebody to directly be attacking your personhood? How can you love them without enabling? How does a wife who is being physically abused by her husband love him, but also love herself? Forgiving and forgetting that abuse is happening is not love, but just keeping quiet about it, it doesn't seem like that's love. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. That's not love. But what is it? How do we engage with our enemies? You know, if you're not a fan of Trump, which probably, you know, I would imagine most people in here aren't like tremendous fans of Trump, but maybe, you know, I don't know. But how do we love our enemy of Donald Trump? How do you rightfully and righteously resist an enemy while still loving them? And how far can you take that? Welcome to the Liturgist Podcast, everybody.
So I wonder what science has to say about that. So here's the thing. Among all the social mammals we've ever encountered in biology, Homo sapiens are by far the most violent. In fact, when we look back at the fossil record about 2 million years ago, something remarkable happened. Our ancestors figured out how to sharpen and throw sticks. And as soon as that happened, large predator and herbivore populations across the entire continent of Africa were decimated. And as Homo sapiens spread from the cradle of our birthplace across the entire globe, that same pattern continued. Everywhere you found populations of humans, you found a reduction in the populations of competitive species. Now, we don't know exactly when human language developed. We don't know the relationship between tool making, for example, and language, but we know that once we begin to speak, we begin to ascribe a set of characteristics among those who oppose us as our enemies. Now, scientists don't agree exactly when we created war, but some scientists believe that we actually waged war before we even had civilization, while others say that war was probably non-existent among hunter-gatherers. But either way, we're certain that hunter-gatherers were incredibly violent. Most men died at the hands of other men before the dawn of civilization. And this typically came from disputes over mates, territory, or honor. Which is a little weird, right? Like, I get being upset about mate over a competition or competition over a mate. That's necessary for gene propagation. I understand territory offers you resources, but honor? What is honor? It's sure as hell not scientific. But when we look at chimpanzees, our closest relative, we learn a lot more about violence. Chimps are another primate that wages war. But oddly enough, chimps only wage war when there's an incredible disparity between the sizes of two opposing population groups. Homo sapiens, we found, statistically, we'll go to war with a population difference as small as 3%, which is almost mutually assured destruction. Once we created civilization, we went heartily into war. War has been an unending part of the human experience ever since. And why do I talk about war in the context of enemies? Well, when we understand what we fight over, we understand how we create enemies. We require social labels to create enemies to sustain societal war, war on a civilization or nation-state level. It means we have to be able to say that these people are Jews and these people are Arabs, these people are white and these people are black, these people are gay or straight or Christian or Protestant or atheist. As soon as we introduce labels, we give our brains, our cognitive fabric, a shortcut in how to define someone as not friend but foe. And in fact, one of the earliest things our brains do after birth is to create a neurological algorithm designed to decide who is in the tribe and who is not. And that is the neurofoundation of thy enemy. But even without war, we love to have enemies. We love to have Darth Vader. We love to have the Death Star. And nowhere is this passion more evident than in the Bible itself. This is Sarah Heath. Sarah is the pastor of the First United Methodist Church in Costa Mesa, California, and she came up with the whole Science Mike thing.
You have heard it said that you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, you should love your neighbor and love your enemy. What are we supposed to do about that? Do we throw the whole Bible out? Because that doesn't make any sense to me. How am I supposed to love someone that is actively doing negative things to me? When we look at Scripture, I think often too quickly we come to these judgments. We decide that the whole thing doesn't make any sense because if I look at one part and the other part and what I've been told, it doesn't go together. But just for a little bit, let's dive into Matthew together. Matthew. It begins with, you should love your enemy. But it keeps going. To add insult to injury, not only am I supposed to love them, but if they slap me in the face, then I need to turn my face. Jesus is pulling a ninja move. I mean it. See, if my right hand strikes your cheek and I turn my face, you have a decision to make. Are you going to hit me with your left hand? Because in culture then, if I hit you with my left hand, which, by the way, was the toilet paper hand, you're welcome for that knowledge. I couldn't do that. See, if I hit you, if I struck you on the cheek, I was saying you are less than me. But Jesus says, turn your cheek because then they gotta fight you like an equal. See, Scripture is all about subversion and power dynamics, and we're the ones who got it wrong. If someone asks for your cloak, you're supposed to give them all your clothes. As Brené Brown would say, now you're vulnerable. Nothing is more uncomfortable for you or someone else, unless you're Science Mike who doesn't mind this, but getting naked in front of people is not normally a normal, you're comfortable thing. Being nude in that culture didn't just shame you, it actually shamed the people who were looking upon you. It's a power dynamic. Like, how ninja? Like, you want to mess with me? I'm getting naked. Now what? You want to start this fight? Nobody fights the naked guy. Unless you're Greek. Next time you're in a bar fight, don't throw a table, take your clothes off.
That's good advice.
It is. Yes, I agree. What do we do with this? See, if Jesus doesn't want us to be meek and powerless, he wants something more. As we look at Scripture, so let's keep going through Matthew. We get to Matthew 10. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, if you're me, I liked peaceful Jesus. Isn't he great? Like, I couldn't put him on my dashboard. He's great. He was my boyfriend for a while in college. Peaceful Jesus. Guard your heart. I mean, I wanted you to be peaceful. What do you mean I did not come to bring peace, but a sword? As I have matured in my faith, as I've spent time in Scripture, what I have discovered is that Jesus didn't come for us to be non-active. See, oftentimes we think peace looks like if I walk away. Some people take Scripture and they use it horribly and they say, you know, Jesus said, take a sword. Give me one instance of Jesus wielding a sword. Instead, he is using Micah 7. He's hearkening back to the Old Testament saying, the sword will divide. So what I'm about to say to you is uncomfortable, and you're going to have to choose a side. Justice, wow. Injustice, enemy, peace. You got to choose. But do not for a minute think that peace exists when no one is fighting. How do I love my enemy? And you may have heard, like, turn the other cheek, but here's the thing we never talk about. Turning the other cheek means I never left. I stayed in the room with you. You're uncomfortable, but I'm going to stay near you. People always ask me, why do you stay in the church? Why are you a pastor? And I'm like, mostly it's the pay. That's not... not true. I stay there because I believe in the kingdom of God. And I believe when Jesus said, love your enemy, he didn't mean get on Facebook, get in your own algorithm, and never have to meet up with anyone who doesn't agree with you. Because every Sunday, I sit beside people who don't agree with me. Or the fact that I'm the one who's like, sorry, I'm your pastor, I'm a girl. I have to be near my enemy for them to strike me. I had a professor who I adored. He knew what he was talking about when he talked about peace. His name was Bishop Peter Story. We don't often hear about him. He's Desmond Tutu's best friend. He happens to be the Caucasian part of the story. And he often goes into the background because he knows that Desmond is often much better at speaking. Dr. Story told us this story that I think talks about how we're to treat our enemies. You see, he had been taken out to a field with his best friend Desmond because they had been holding church services where both races were together during apartheid. And a man had held a gun to both of their heads. By the way, when he tells you pacifism's the way to go, you're like, absolutely. He said it wasn't long after that they were in worship. And they continued to worship black and white. And the guards came in and they were ready to fight. They had guns. And Desmond Tutu gets up to the mic and giggles and says, you have come to join the winning side. Come, we have seats for you. The soldiers didn't know what to do because now they were face to face with their own ugly. And their only choice was to sit down and worship. And they did. Years later, Bishop Story was at an event where he was speaking and someone came up and he said, you probably don't recognize me, but I'm the man that was told to murder you that day, and I couldn't. Loving your enemies is not about being passive or maintaining some sort of weird peace where we just don't talk about the tough stuff like Thanksgiving with our family. Loving our enemies is risky, it's scary, and it's biblical.
Let's thank Sarah.
There's a world at war, caught in suffering, silent casualties. Oh God, grant us peace. In these sleepless nights, I can hardly breathe. Despite brutality, I know that we'll be free. I know that we'll be free. So let the light keep it shining. Let it break into the darkness. All the love dares us to see. We'll all be free. So let the light keep it shining. Let it break into the darkness. All the love dares us to see. We'll all be free.
Oh, we'll be free. Free, we'll all be free. let the light in, keep it shining. Let it break into the darkness. All the love dares us to see, we'll all be free. Let the light in, keep it shining. Let it break into the darkness. All the love dares us to see, we'll all be free. We'll all be. We'll all be free.
This is William Matthews. William is an artist advocate who writes, tweets, and sings at the intersection of spirituality and justice. William, good to have you on the program, as always.
Thank you, man, for having me.
You may recognize that voice from episode 34 of the Liturgist podcast, Black and White, Racism in America. So
good to be here with you guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for being here. Man, enemies. We were talking about this the other day.
We were. And it got real complicated real quick.
It did. So we're just going to bring it to the complication to everybody.
That's how we roll.
So do you ever think and feel in your experience that people misuse the phrase love your enemy?
Absolutely. I think the question that you kind of asked was, do you ever feel like the church particularly abuses that word? And I think church, particularly as it relates to it being an institutional power, is always looking to protect its power, privilege, and status. And so by doing so, I think the term love your enemy gets or becomes code for abuse. And I think a lot of us have experienced in church situations where abusive behavior was happening, whether emotionally, spiritually, or even physically, and in order to protect the group, the community, the innocence and the purity of it all, something gets covered up. A scapegoat is always created. And love of enemy, or the scripture, is often contorted and used to manipulate people and to manipulate situations. And unfortunately, too many of us get put in abusive situations where we feel like God wants us to be abused.
Like 70 times 7, and you're an altar boy in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, ugh.
I know, you know, it's wrong, but I mean, you don't say anything, you know. I know that you were touched inappropriately, but, you know, it's not worth, you know, so-and-so's he's a good priest, he's a good pastor, they're a good leader. We don't, you know, want to say anything bad about them.
Yeah, it's interesting the difference between, like, Jesus saying, love your enemy, or, like, Caesar saying, love your enemy.
What's the difference sometimes when it comes to church and Caesar? That's
exactly.
Yeah, I know it's not Jesus, but the...
Well, today it may be ambiguous, but I think clearly there's a historical difference between Christ's church and Rome. Christ was crucified, and Rome used crucifixion. And it seems like we lose, as Sarah was talking about, that subversive element of these stories when we use them to prop up imperial powers, when we use them to prop up government authority, when we use them to erase the stories of people who are crushed underneath it. It erases the entire context of the New Testament, which was the beloved city of Jerusalem, the holy city of Jerusalem, that should be under no one's authority but God, sitting under the authority of Caesar.
Yeah.
And when we flip that, it is literally like Roman centurions marching into Jerusalem and saying, hey, love your enemy, like while they stab people, while they illegally acquire property, while they oppress. And if you ignore the power dynamic in the story, you completely eliminate its ability to speak truth, in my opinion.
I think as a culture, we just struggle with truth-telling in general. So I think as Americans, we're culturalized to be nice, right? Like, We're culturalized to not say anything that's going to ruffle feathers or not speak truth to power. Or, you know, we were at dinner the other night and someone talked about they didn't like their dish and they talked about it. And we all just sat there a little cringe, like, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, and but then I checked myself, like, why is them saying to the restaurant what they didn't like? Like, why do I feel that that's wrong? Like, why? And I realized even the other night, I was like, that was so, I'm so culturalized to not ruffle anything and just go along and pretend everything's all right. And I just think as a culture, we don't like truth telling. We have a hard time with people who tell the truth. I mean, Jesus said, you know, you who kill the prophets. And I think our whole culture is littered with painting people who speak truth as mean and divisive and hateful. And painting this character of, if you disrupt power, you are hateful, you are bad, you are un-American. And truthfully, it's if you speak truth, not niceness. But sometimes truth is loud, and sometimes truth is angry. And I think culturally, we don't allow ourselves the space to feel all those things and to express those things without feeling a sense of challenge or feeling like somebody is, being hateful.
I mean, I feel like when we so think of ourselves as individuals. We so want to feel like an empowered individual. And we sometimes forget the effect, and don't even forget, just don't notice how we just kind of fit into the thing, into the structure, into the easy way of existing within society. It's just, and groupthink takes over, and it happens to all of us. And we have these, our consciousness does get informed by the world that we're in. I remember being in at Auschwitz and seeing this town, and it was just striking how normal this town was. About, you know, I remember being outside of the gates of this, like, one of the most horrendous things in history, where there's smoke billowing into these neighborhoods and of ashes of people, humans. And I see all this little old lady walking, and I was like, she's old enough. She was hobbling down the sidewalk. She's like, she may have been here. She may have seen that ash. And like, what is everybody in town doing? I don't know. And can I say that I would have been a lot different than the normal town person if I had been in the exact same circumstances? You can't say something like that. You don't know.
I think it's also part of our American liturgy, so to speak, right? And our, like, there's a propaganda, even, you know, with the analogy you're using with Auschwitz, like, there was this propaganda that propped up, so to speak. I wish we had propaganda here. I love that guy. Shout out to Prop.
We invited him. He's on tour.
Shout out to Prop. Yeah, he's on tour. Shout out to Prop. We love him. There's a propaganda, though, that props up this American liturgy, or in that sense, it was the German, the Nazi liturgy that, you know, don't question, don't speak up, don't challenge, you know. And I think we forget how that is the cultural context that we're all socialized into, that creates very nice neutered people.
So you might not believe this.
What?
But I'm not a native Los Angeles citizen. I haven't always lived here. It's hard to tell because I have an amazing professional broadcast voice, but I thought I'd get a better laugh. Honestly, a little disappointed. I grew up in the Southeast and lived there until, like, what, 7 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, something like that. And when you talk about this American liturgy, this propaganda, let's remember that European culture especially was steeped in a particular structure that was designed to preserve a social hierarchy and to especially benefit those who were most in power. And so as we moved out of the feudal system and we got into the Magna Carta and we got into some everybody has rights situations, everybody of the right ethnicity has rights situations, we started to create protocols that people were indoctrinated with from birth that prioritized what? Being polite, being pleasant, and being nice. These are all values I hold deeply as a Southerner, right? If I don't think about it, I say, yes, ma'am. I say, yes, sir. I tend to hold the door open for everybody. In fact, Michael laughs sometimes because I literally won't walk through the door until everyone else does, and am perfectly comfortable having a really long standoff to be the nicest.
I tried to beat him one. I tried to beat him. It got absurd. It was absurd. I was like, no, you. Because I was like, I'm not going to let him do it this time. No, you. Sorry, this doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about.
And one time I beat both of them.
It was so long.
So it comes back.
I didn't have the southern chops, the southern manner chops to hold up.
This is designed. Well, if a billionaire is polite to me, then I feel elevated. And there's some truth to that.
I mean, if Oprah smiled at me, I'd like
right.
freak
out.
Right,
if Oprah held the door for you, you'd be like, oh my gosh,
yeah,
that's amazing.
Like, I'm like, I'm on another level. But I'm on a new level.
But the hairy back of that situation, it looks nice, and then if you turn it around, it's kind of surprising, is this nice culture prevents us from critiquing the status quo. So what happens when a trans person says your comfort with where you use the restroom ends up dramatically increasing my risk of sexual assault? What do we say? Whoa, that's not a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
What if a person of color says, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but it turns out people with my skin color get arrested, charged, and incarcerated at a much higher rate than white people for the same crimes. We go, whoa, 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 that's not nice.
Yeah.
What if native indigenous people to the United States say, by the way, you literally stole every inch of the land your house is on from my ancestors through brutal genocide. We go, whoa, that's not nice. Don't you understand we're elevated now? You're just like us. We're all nice together, and that means I'll say yes, sir, to you as you drive home to an Indian reservation, and I drove home to a nice suburban house.
But, Mike, they worked really hard for that house.
They worked hard for it. Not minimizing that. What I am saying in this conversation about enemies is sometimes the very structure of an enemy becomes systemic in nature and impersonal and almost becomes more nefarious in that. Like, what is more traumatizing? People marching in the streets in white hoods? Or a disproportionate number of black fathers rotting away in prison? Which one of these feels more like an enemy?
Makes me think of that. This is going to be me trying to quote scripture for you. Okay?
Gone, Vishnu, gone. Let him use you.
We battle not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. And that was always, when I was a kid, that was like demons. It was like, we're battling demons, not people.
Mimetic demons.
But yeah, now it's like when demons. You see...
It's a whole nother conversation.
When you see these powers that do move society and do move individuals within society to just kind of fit in that slot that they belong in so that they don't get hurt or be seen as mean or whatever, to whatever degree, or killed in some societies. I think that seeing... This is a tricky thing because then you can get into the like, you can sound like the people that are like, love the sinner, hate the sin. And it can become simplistic. But I think somehow resisting the evil and the powers of evil that are operating through human beings, but somehow still not having your battle against flesh and blood. I think there is something really fascinating and profound about that.
I think that's where we're at, where that's what we're trying to figure out how to do. And that's why the command of Jesus to love our enemies is so complicated and so complex for us, because I don't know sometimes how to differentiate between the good intentions of a white supremacist. Like, I struggle as a person of color to love my enemy, especially when my enemy is perpetually giving me death by 1,000 paper cuts. in the systemic way, right? If not the utter brutal way, which does happen still.
Or an actual execution.
Or an actual execution. Or a lynching, like the biracial boy who just was just lynched. Wow. You wouldn't think in 2017 that would be a headline. And that still is. So it's both. And so I struggle. I mean, I was listening to Sarah earlier and I told Lisa, I was like, how am I going to go after this? I cannot love my enemy. I struggle. And truthfully, I think that's just my honest confession is I don't know how to love my enemy. Mm. I really don't. And the most I've been able to do is to take small steps toward more inclusion, to value the opinions of those who are different from me. I mean, listen, I'm black, and I spent the majority of my adult life, actually the entirety of my adult life, working for white evangelical churches. That was an exercise in putting myself in situations with people that I don't always agree with. And but I learned a lot through that process, and I'm still learning, and I find I have much more to learn. But I think the only thing I've been able to do is just to consistently fight in my own heart for the space to be inclusive, the space to be more loving, the space to be more open-minded, to hold firm to how of my experience of the world, yet as well to create maybe inroads for people who maybe don't see the world the way that I do. And I hope to offer those inroads to people, and I also pray that those inroads are offered to me.
Let's thank William Matthews.
See my brother. Oh, when I look into
This is Peter Rollins. Peter is the founder of a theory and practice called pyrotheology. And let's welcome Peter to the stage.
Epistemological breakdown.
All right, you can start.
I'm worried they want me to rap. This is terrifying. Is this a dream? Am I in a nightmare? And I'm naked? No, this is awful. Okay, no rapping. The Irish, we're never supposed to rap. Supposedly, actually, Bono loves rapping. And every time they're doing an album, they have to tell him not to rap. So there's a little nugget for you. It's great to be here. I really appreciate being your guest. And you guys, you're doing a great job. You're facing the right way. You're clapping at the right time. You're doing a very good job as an audience. Very good. I do this a lot. I speak in rooms, but mostly there's nobody there, and that's called a mental illness. But when you show up, it makes me look normal. So I really appreciate that. Okay, I just want to reflect a little bit on this idea of loving your enemies. And I want to ask the question, do we love our enemies? And in a particular perverse way, do we love our enemies like a hypochondriac loves their disease, right? You see, a hypochondriac, say, who thinks they've got cancer, they think the cancer is the problem. But the cancer is the solution to a problem. The hypochondriac has anxiety, they have fears, they have guilt, all of this trauma that's going on. And that is externalized onto this thing, the cancer. So they think the cancer is the problem, and they think if we could only get rid of the cancer, everything would be wonderful. But actually, the cancer is protecting the hypochondriac from looking at difficult things in their own life. It's similar with alcohol. If you know somebody who drinks too much, we think that alcoholism is the problem. But actually, alcoholism can be seen very often as the solution to a problem. It's what you do to try to avoid a suffering in your life, something that's gone wrong, some pain, some difficulty in your existence. And if you don't face what's beneath, and if you just concentrate on not drinking, you're going to do something even worse. You're going to take up something even more dangerous. So I live in LA now, and I've seen this firsthand. I don't know if you've seen or heard of CrossFit, okay? It's terrible. Honestly, one moment you're drinking too much, and the next moment you're flipping tires. I have seen it. I have seen it. I'm Irish. There's no way I'm going to do that. But, you know, you just find something else. You just like whack-a-mole, you get rid of one symptom and another one arises if you don't deal with what's beneath it. So the difference between a hypochondriac who thinks they have cancer and then finds out they have cancer, that doesn't mean they're not a hypochondriac. That just means they're a hypochondriac who happens to have the thing that they think they have, right? Just like, you know that phrase, just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you, right? Which means you could have the structure of a paranoid, delusional individual, but the FBI could be out to get you. But it doesn't mean you're not paranoid, delusional. In fact, the fact that the FBI are out to get you just helps hide the reality of your paranoid structure, okay? Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because actually, this is called scapegoating. Scapegoating is when you take, you know, you cannot face your own brokenness, your own suffering, your own difficulties, so you put it onto something else, and you think that's the problem. In fascism, obviously, you know, the stereotypical fascist group is against the Jewish community, and the Jewish community are hated traditionally because they have the education system, they have the banks, the monetary system, and they have the news, they have the media, and so they are scapegoated. And the fascist community says, if only we could get rid of them, then everything would be great. But actually, it's the Jewish community that allow the fascist community to avoid a confrontation with their own crisis, with the problems that exist within it. So if you look at Soviet Russia, the kulaks were seen as the enemy of the people, the kulaks who owned the means of production. But as the kulaks were persecuted, and it became obvious that the kulaks were not really the problem, the kulaks were actually the way that the Soviet system was able to galvanize support, was able to avoid looking at its own crisis. So as they were able to kill the kulaks, they realized that they needed the enemy. So the definition of a kulak began to expand. A kulak wasn't simply someone who owned the means of production. You know, a kulak was someone who employed other farmers, or a kulak was someone who had a little bit more land than everybody else. Eventually, a kulak was someone who thought like a kulak, or a kulak was someone who would think like a kulak if they had the chance. In other words, the definition expanded so much because they needed an enemy. Psychically, you needed the enemy to protect yourself from looking at your own difficulties. This is a defense mechanism, and it's perfectly fine. But what happens is, Hegel called this the beautiful soul. The beautiful soul condition is where you so want to be pure and good and not look at the darkness and the badness that you project it out. You see this with kids. You know that phase where they cannot look at the monstrosity of themselves, so the monster is under the bed. And of course, the monster isn't under the bed. The monster is inside the child. But what you do is you split. The child splits and projects the monster outside of themselves. This beautiful soul notion continues often to function. If you break up with somebody, splitting is one of the defense mechanisms that you see, where you're innocent and pure and the person is evil and bad and wrong. And sometimes they are, you know, sometimes they are. But two people are in this relationship, and when you break up, like, you just want to slag them off. They're terrible, they're awful, etc. Now, if you're a good friend to someone who's splitting, what you'll probably do is you won't affirm it, and also you won't attack it. You'll just wait. You'll wait until there's a moment where that person just starts to pause before they attack, or they hesitate, or there's something in the tapping of their finger that tells you that this is a moment of opportunity. And then you might say something like, "I just think you're hurt. I just think you're really were damaged by this whole breakup." And the person might then turn around and say, "Yeah, you're right. And you know, I'm part of this as well. And maybe I've got something to look at." And then at this point, the person's defense begins to lower. They begin to work through their own suffering. And then this splitting begins to break. And it gets to the point where the person might be able to actually think good thoughts about the other person, or maybe meet them in the street and actually shake their hand and say, "I wish things had worked out, I wish things had been different, but it's good to see you." So these defenses that we put up can protect us from looking at our own difficulties, and so we want an enemy. Now, that doesn't mean that all enemies work like this. You could be a healthy person who happens to have cancer. You don't need the cancer. You're not psychically invested in it. So you can actually try to address it, try to, you know, find ways to get over it. But are you, or am I, psychically invested in my enemies? Do my enemies give me a way to feel pure and good and divorced? If you've ever seen social justice within churches, it's interesting. Often we do social justice because we think, you know, the homeless is the problem, or the prison population is the problem, and we want to be good news to the other. But that can make us feel very pure and very good. We are kind of like the voice of God to the other. But what if homelessness is not the problem? What if it's the solution to a problem? What if the prison population is not the problem? It's the solution to a problem. The problem is in our society. inequality, inability to deal with mental health issues, wealth disparity, whatever. And these problems, our refusal to face them, means that we create a symptom. And the symptom is the homeless population that we can then manage and work with and feel good about ourselves because we're trying to help. But what if actually the homeless are good news to us? They tell us that we are participating in a system that is problematic and that we have to do the hard work of looking at that and working through how we change that. And as we do that, the symptom begins to diminish. You see, a symptom is that thing that tells the truth that you cannot speak. So in your own life, you might have headaches, migraines, bad back, heart palpitations. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, and those are just health things you've got. But sometimes they may be telling you something that you cannot tell yourself, that you're in a job that you despise, a relationship that's abusive, that you're in a family environment that's bad. When you cannot speak your truth finds a way to speak. And that is the symptom. And the challenge is to listen to your symptom, not just try to get rid of it, right? Not just try to, if there's violence in your society, go, right, we want to get rid of the violence. But the more difficult question is to go, is that an explosion of something that is problematic in our wider society that we have to look at? And if you do that, the psychoanalyst Lacan talks about how your symptom can become, and he just basically writes symptom in a slightly more archaic way, a symptom, the French symptom, which is S-I-N-T-H-O-M-E. A symptom in French is not just a symptom, it also sounds like holy man, symptom, holy man. Your symptom becomes a prophet that speaks to you, that tells you that there's something that you have to address and look at in your society. And if you listen to the prophets, changes happen. And if we refuse to listen, they don't. So just to kind of finish off this very brief reflection, do we need our enemies? Is there something that we get out of it that means actually unconsciously we don't want to get rid of them? I don't know if you ever saw, there was a sign that said, the Democratic Party used, that said, love trumps hate. It was a popular sign. And it meant, you know, love is better than hate. And it also meant Trump was someone who was hateful and love is better than that. But there was another way to read the sign, which is just literally, love trumps hate. How many of us love it, get something out of it? How many of us are psychically invested in it? Great jokes, great humor, great this, great that, great sense of we are pure and we are good. And actually we end up wanting our enemy, and therefore unconsciously not wanting to get rid of them because they purify us, they help us have a beautiful soul. It's interesting that Judge Dredd came out of the US. Judge Dredd's interesting because Judge Dredd, he finds a criminal, he judges them there and then, and he, if needs be, executes them. In popular culture, Judge Dredd is the ultimate in concrete justice. He's not abstract. He's concrete. He looks at the problem, there's an evil, and he deals with it. He's concrete, not abstract. But in philosophy, those terms are the opposite way around. Judge Dredd is the ultimate in abstract justice. Because to understand something, you have to concretize it in its network, in its wider structure, to understand it. To abstract something is to take something out of its context and just judge it. Judge Dredd abstracts a criminal from what was his education or her education, where was she brought up, what family was he from. So Judge Dredd abstracts the enemy from their context and judges them. The difficulty for us all is to ask ourselves, you know, what are we getting out of the society that we're in? We can purify ourselves by hating something. But the really difficult question is to ask, am I participating in a system that actually perpetuates problems and difficulties, injustices and racism and inequalities? And that's a difficult question to ask. So do we love our enemy like a hypochondriac loves their disease?
So we talk about, like, I've actually never considered the idea of needing the enemy ever, so bravo. But I started thinking about our nearest genetic relatives who I alluded to earlier in the program, chimpanzees, and how they so readily engage in inter and intragroup conflict, right? They're really, really, really violent primates. Not human violent, but close. And there's another species just as closely related to Homo sapiens as chimpanzees, and that's bonobos. And bonobos are not violent. When bonobos have conflict within a group, they express their frustration, and then they stimulate each other's genitals. And usually around the time of mutual orgasm, the conflict is no longer a problem. And so bonobos very much make love, not war. And these species are almost genetically identical. I mean, really, really, they almost push the boundary between a species and a subspecies. But the behavior is so radically different. And when primatologists have tried to uncover the differences in these behaviors, it's geographic separation. Chimpanzees generally live in environments where, due to seasonality, competition for food and water is intense. And bonobos live in a region where the climate is stable and the food supply is plentiful. In fact, there's so much food, some of their favorite fruit frequently ferments. So bonobos not only get to hang out, they also get a pretty good buzz. And it's interesting to me that our two closest genetic relatives kind of speak to the different approaches we have to relating to each other and the different strategies we have for dealing with an enemy, right? We literally have a State Department and a Defense Department, a Bomb People Department, and where does this tension come from? Well, I think, as you said, resources is a huge thing. The degree to which resources are available and distributed drives our ability to create an enemy. But a chimpanzee, I don't know, is necessarily projecting onto his enemy. He is actually just trying to get food. But we have this capacity to be aware of inequality, to produce agriculture, to have shipping capacities. And interestingly enough, on the right and the left, for example, if you want to drive Americans crazy, talk about reparations for slavery. Talk about reparations for Native genocide. And on the right and the left, you'll have the same reaction, like, whoa, where's that money going to come from? And then an excuse about why the other party is the root of inequality. And as you said, like, this need to project our own inadequacy to create an enemy. Like, how comfortable are we right now, as progressive people, to have Trump to demonize, to hide the fact that we're so comfortable having so much more than other people? Oh, man, that was so convicting for me. So how do you think we start to become aware of the way we're externalizing and start to process through that projection to be more whole, healthy people?
Wow, very good. That's a big question. you know, my interest, and this would take us very, very deep, we can't really go here, but
it's a literature podcast.
Okay. Well, I want to say, interestingly, that chimpanzees and whatever don't seem to go through the eatable complex. And I put a lot of emphasis on this eatable story. Now, very quickly, what's the eatable story? Well, it's a guy He wants to sleep with his mum. He doesn't know it's his mum, but he wants to have sex with his mum. And his father's in the way. And so he kills his father, sleeps with his mother. He thinks it's going to be wonderful, but it's a disaster, right? Now, one way of understanding what that means is that the mother here is a symbol of returning to oceanic oneness, wholeness, and completeness. And the father is a symbol of a prohibition that gets in the way of that return. And the son breaks through the prohibition, returns to wholeness and completeness, thinks it's going to be wonderful, but it's a disaster. Now, the Jewish community has its own Oedipal story, which is Adam and Eve. It's very similar structure. Adam and Eve are walking around a garden. There's a prohibition, and behind the prohibition, there's, you have this piece of fruit, and then you will be like God. And that means you will be whole and complete, right? And there's this serpent that's saying it. You eat the fruit and you'll be like God. And this isn't even an iPhone 7 or something. It's just a piece of fruit, right? Like, you wonder, why is it so appealing? But it's the prohibition. If you ever take a toy off a child, you'll notice that sometimes the very act of taking the mundane toy away generates an excessive attachment to the toy, and then the child goes crazy to have the toy, right? Now, in psychoanalysis, the serpent is called the superego. That is the voice that tells you, you can be whole and complete if only you have enough sex or go out enough or nicer to your mother or whatever, right? That's the superego. In theology, it's called the serpent. And in psychoanalysis, the idea is to realize the superego doesn't exist. In theology, it's to exorcise the serpent. And the technology of psychoanalysis is, of course, the clinic. But the technology of theology is grace, which is you don't have to do anything. You don't have to pursue this frantic idea of something that makes you whole and complete. Now, why am I saying all of that? Very quickly to say this. When we are caught up in this Oedipal problem, we start to fantasize there's something wonderful and amazing, and if only we could have it, everything would be great. And then we start to fantasize that there's some enemy that's preventing us from getting it. And then we want to get rid of that enemy, destroy them to get the thing that will make us whole and complete. This is the scapegoating mechanism. Yeah. And it's that which I think is a very particular form of human evil. It's a very particular form of human problem. So, for example, you'll see that enemies are often, in films, they've got everything. The Joker has a smile etched on his face. He's having excessive pleasure. The enemy has the thing that makes them happy, and we want to take it away from them. That's why there's that old Romanian parable of this farmer, and this angel comes to the farmer and says, oh, God has seen how good you are, how carefully you tend the land. He wants to give you anything you want. And the farmer is about to speak, and then the angel says, and it gets even better than that, because whatever God gives you, God will give your neighbor double. And so the farmer says, take one of my eyes. Because we so hate the other having the thing that we think will make us whole and complete that we despise them. So my whole thing is, how do we escape this Oedipal curse? Embrace our own brokenness and our own unknowing. Embrace grace, which means you don't have to do anything. Don't frantically pursue this sacred object. And in doing that, you will find yourself not libidinally invested in this scapegoating mechanism. I mean, that's a lot for...
Sorry. That's great. I loved what you were saying in the way that it's so easy to look at an enemy... And it feels like you're objectively judging that situation, that person, that system, whatever. And I love how you were calling attention back inward a bit, because I think, like, if we just take a second here, I'll say some words and just pay attention to yourself. Pay attention to how these words resonate in you. Western Christianity. GOP, Southern Evangelical Alliance of Christians.
Biblically inerrant.
Okay, now let's switch it up just in case. I mean, we are in LA. Those are probably but we'll switch it up. Immigrants. immigrants, the liberal elite, Hillary.
What happened?
No, but were there any words in there that you can go ahead and be, were there any words that made something and you go, eek? Just on a, you can be honest. Yeah, I see a little hand. Yes. Interesting. Like, none of those things did anything right now while I said those words. Like, these are just ideas. Said these names, words, and we have this little, you have this thing. And one thing that I've really been learning and experiencing more over the last couple of years, especially the last year, is those things outside of myself that I have let, that I have experienced suffering from. The enemies, the Ken Hams of the world.
Inside joke.
Sort of. And the people that have, that I've had battle with on outside that I feel like have caught, like, what have you done in my life? And to realize that every feeling and experience that I've ever had with any enemy is an experience that I've had within me. That those sufferings and those tensions and those are all something that happened inside of me, not outside of me. And I think the Buddhists here have a lot of beautiful wisdom to teach as far as suffering goes and how suffering is always related to our attachment. And I think this talk about enemies, it's often a matter of perspective, because it's so easy to assume this really solid me that has this objective point of view and this really solid them that is out there, and that I have a full view of what's actually happening, and this is what's wrong with them, and this is how they've wronged me or us or whatever. And when you can step back a little bit and see what's happening internally, this is what's a beautiful thing about meditation or spiritual practice, and you can step back far enough to see, like, oh, look, my ego is really hurt. This ego is feeling hurt because I didn't feel like my thoughts were respected or whatever. And you can just kind of see it. And you see that brought up some suffering because apparently my ego really cares about that sort of thing. But that practice, when you move far enough into that, you can kind of eventually see that all of your interactions, all of the enemy, the us and the them, it's all happening in your own mind and your perception and your narratives and the things that are going on. And I think when you can shift, and I would imagine this is where Jesus was coming from, is being able to see, when he said, Lord, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. There was this deep, it wasn't an idealism to like push on somebody. When somebody's mean, this is what you should do. But like so deeply entrenched and connected to the all and to the what we assume is the other, that the divine is no more distant in that enemy than it is my own breath or my own spiritual practice. It's just pervasive. And I think then you can love, I think you can actually love your enemy because you can see they don't exist.
Yeah, can I mention something?
Yeah.
Because we have back in Belfast, we developed a series of things called decentering practices. And one of them was called the Evangelism Project, where we went to be evangelized by other people. So we would go to, say, a fundamentalist church or the Jewish society or the atheist community or whatever it is, to be evangelized by them. Now, it was called the Evangelism Project, but the evangelism didn't really happen when this community, say it was the Islamic Society, told us about what they believed. Now, somebody might be evangelized, that was totally fine. But the reason why we called it the Evangelism Project was because halfway through, we would say, so what do we look like to you? And then you would see yourself through the other's eyes, and you would be evangelized, because you would maybe see pollutions in your own life, in your own community, that you just couldn't see, because I need your eyes in order to see myself. There are things that I hide from myself. I find it funny, we often talk about what you believe, and people say, what do you believe? As if we know what we believe. Our consciousness is designed to protect you from ever even glimpsing what you believe. Mm. None of you believe that a duvet cover will protect you from a knife attack, unless it's late at night and you hear something downstairs, and then you get all Harry Potter, and suddenly it's an invisible cloak that you put over your head, right? Now, if you believe it, you just don't know you believe it. In fact, that's why you do things like psychoanalysis, is because you realize that coming to know what you believe is a profoundly difficult thing. So the Evangelism Project is to help you see yourself. Like, traditionally, say, for example, you're all Democrats and you're all Republicans. A debate is the Democrats want you to become Democrat and the Republicans want you to become Republican. But in the Evangelism Project, it was slightly different. The Democrats would say, listen, we're unlikely to convince you, but maybe you can make us better Democrats. Tell us what you see in us that's so bad, because we think we're great and perfect and fantastic. And then you see some things maybe that you never thought about. You see yourself through the other's eyes and go, okay, maybe we're a bit hippy-dippy and, you know, we're not like political enough or whatever. And then what happens, interestingly, is the other side are more open to doing the same thing and say, well, you're not likely going to make us, you know, we're not going to make you Republicans, but maybe you'll make us better Republicans. What do you see in us that's so bad? And if remember, like in an argument where two people are fighting and you see something on the news and you say one thing and your partner says the other, within 5 minutes, you're arguing like world experts. Until someone says, to be honest, I don't really know what I'm talking about. I could be wrong. The other person might go, ha ha, I win. But they might also say, well, to be honest, don't really know what I'm talking about either. And then a real conversation can happen. So the problem with splitting, the big problem, forget about the morality of it. The major problem with splitting is no novelty can occur. When, like in Northern Ireland, you had Protestants and Catholics and they were each other's enemies, you could not talk about the other as anything but horrific and awful and terrible. But eventually, life got so bad that we had to drop the splitting and we had to say, is there another way to communicate? And when you drop that, novelty occurs. In other words, you start to find creative ways to engage with argument. See, war is not conflict. Don't ever think war is conflict. War is the inability to have conflict. There's a great Irish comedian, Dylan Moran, said this, is when war is when you cannot stand to be in the room with another person and argue and disagree and fight. So you want to take out a gun and blow their brains out. But when you are able to put down war, then you can start to have conflict. And with conflict comes novelty, and with novelty can come the possibility of change.
I mean, I've been on this journey in my life for the last couple of years, getting past the reflex to never admit that I'm someone else's enemy. And that can show up in really surprising ways in your life. But I've learned through scholarship and lived experiences that sometimes the cultural context I live in, the systems I participate in, make me an enemy to others. You know, how would a teenager relate to me in Afghanistan if his older brother died from a drone strike? I mean, how did these children I met in a Palestinian refugee camp relate to me as I drove on roads that said a gift to the people of Palestine from the United States? And then in the camp, we found tear gas casings and rubber bullets stamped made in the USA. Sometimes I am an enemy. And if I refuse to say to the other, no, no, I'm your friend. No, no, I'm with you. Then I fail to listen to the ways that critique can help me become a more whole person. The ways that the inside of my participation in their oppression could in some way meaningfully not only address their suffering, but start to create a solution. To love our enemies as Christ has commanded means we have to admit sometimes we are enemies. And whether that's some projection of our consciousness escaping the oneness, as Peter said, sometimes the tumors are real. Sometimes the suffering comes from something in the external world. And until we've done the work to admit how much we need the enemy and how much we also never want to be the villain, we can't fully engage in the work of making shalom universal in human justice or dragging the kingdom of heaven near.
Thank you, Peter Rollins. Let's give him a hand. Thanks for being part.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Liturgist Podcast, live for like the first time ever. Yeah. We'd love to hear your feedback. You can do so by going to theliturgist.com/podcasts. Catch us on Twitter at theliturgists, facebook.com/theliturgists, or in the lobby. Okay. If you're a patron, patrons in the house, anybody there? Wow, okay. Check the app for your invitation to the after party tomorrow. We also want to let you know we're doing two more Liturgist gatherings in Boston and Seattle, and we're going to announce tonight that the special guest in Boston will be Christina Cleveland, and the special guest in Seattle will be Hillary McBride. So pretty good stuff. Make sure you listen to that online or visit us in person. And we want to thank Sarah Heath, William Matthews, Peter Rollins, Lisa Gunger, and Iris Chandler for joining us tonight.
And the strings. The strings.
And the strings.
How about the string players?
Yeah. We'd like to thank our boy Corey Pig and Jim Chafee for helping put the Liturgist Gathering together. We want to thank Greg Nordine for his production work on this podcast. And of course, I'm Science Mike.
I'm Michael Gunger. Thanks for listening, everybody.